so you get those two kinds of reactions, like this is awesome, it's the best thing since baked bread, and or like I don't want to be anywhere near that initiative. So that's kind of like what we're trying to the bridge we're trying to build between those two groups.
Welcome to Intrinsically Motivated, where we have conversations with experts in the field of addiction, recovery, and those personally affected by it, as we seek to mobilize the church to replace addiction and mental health challenges with flourishing. On today's episode, we'll be sitting down with the founding director of the ETSU Ballad Health Strong Brain Institute, Wally Dixon. We'll be talking about adverse childhood experiences and how they can affect individuals' brain development. I'm Tucker Clements, audio engineer and editor for Uplift Appalachia, and this is Intrinsically Motivated.
The first question that I have to ask you, since you have worked with my mom for now how many years? 20-something years, right? So how would you assume that my psychologist mother has broken me up to this point?
Has done what?
Has broken me up to this
point. Has broken you.
Yeah, knowing her and knowing that I grew up in her household, how am I broken at this point?
So to answer that question, I wouldn't. So your mother is a very hard worker and is in the lab a lot. And so to hear that she's around you enough that she could have broken you is good.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you could imagine a scientist in the lab holed away and not even being at home ever.
You don't have to say nice things about her. I was trying to get some, I need some dirt. You're the one that sees her when she's not around the rest of it. No, it's okay. So you're also at East Tennessee State University. You're
also in
the psychology department there. So what all is your role? I know you have lots of different things that you have been involved in and are involved in. So I'd love to know a little bit about what all you do.
So I started at ETSU as a department chair for the Department of Psychology. I was hired in 2002, and I served as a department chair for 21 years after that, which is a pretty long time for a department chair to play in that role. But what I was able to do, if I can just give you some developmental metrics that we have, is when I started, you know, one of the goals of ETSU is to promote growth and development. So when I started, we had 270 majors. And when I stepped down, we had 610 majors. We had five graduate assistantships available for our graduate master's program. And we were able to develop that to something like 40 graduate assistantships and two PhD programs. We have a accredited APA clinical psychology program. And we have a translational experimental psychology PhD program. So I built it up a lot. We went from 7 faculty when I started to right now we have about 18. So almost tripled. Technically, we should have about 20, but we have a couple of unfilled positions. Yeah.
That's a big department for ETSU.
But it's huge. And also to see it change from 2002 to the present was a pretty significant change.
Yeah. So did you always think that you would end up in academia? Was that always a trajectory for you?
It depends on how you define always.
At what point did you know that this is where I'm heading? Or was it that you just kind of, were you passionate about psychology first and then you found you decided I'd go into academia?
So I didn't even think about having a career in academia. Nobody in my neighborhood went to college. I was a first-generation college student. Really, when I think back only, I can think of two people that were younger than me in my neighborhood that ever went to college. So when I went to college, I always listened to the radio and the news, and I would hear news stories about studies show whatever. And I was always like, well, what studies show this? How does that happen? And then when I was in college, I started realizing when I was going to classes, like, oh, these studies that we're reading about in these books are the studies that show things. But when I started, I didn't even know that psychology was an option. I didn't even know what it was. I started out as a forest industries management major. Thought that
very
would be
different
cool.
Than psychology.
Yeah. And I before that, I was a pre-vet med major.
Okay.
And they talked me out of that. When I went to Ohio State my first year, flunked out miserably, got my act together, transferred to the University of Toledo, and decided I didn't want to be a flunk out. I didn't have a model to go with either because there was nobody that had been through college before. And so I just decided I don't want to be a loser and drop out of college. And I got my act together and ended up graduating. And in that process, I started working in some baby labs at the University of Toledo found it fascinating. You could have a whole science of babies and child development. So I became interested in that and decided to learn about grad school. I was working alongside of graduate students. I learned about grad school, that it was something I could do. I also learned that in psychology, graduate school is free. They pay for your tuition and they provide you a stipend, a small stipend, which these days is not enough to live on. But that was a lot. It was enough to allow me to get my PhD in child psychology. And then because I wasn't in the area of clinical psychology, I decided to pursue an academic path. So I got a job as a college professor and never looked back.
And now you're the one doing the studies that now people are saying.
That's right.
Studies say.
That's right. Yeah.
So I guess, are there any things outside of psychology that you're still passionate about? I know we were talking about IPAs right before this, but
I'm an academic nerd.
Right.
I identify with my profession. You know, historically, people have called me Mr. Psychology just because I look at everything in my life through a scientific lens, which isn't always helpful because you don't always have data. But I always try to make decisions based on data, and so I don't view it as like a day job and a night job. I view my identity as a psychologist, which I get to do for pay in the daytime, and in the evening I just get to be one for free.
You get to just think about it the rest of the time.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that's cool. So, I mean, we were talking about this right before we got going, but obviously our organization that I work with, Uplift Appalachia, we're trying to, you know, train the faith community in things like trauma-informed care and adverse childhood experiences and that sort of thing. And most of the brain and the science-y talk is stuff that my mom does in a lot of our trainings because she's the psychologist, you know, that sort of thing. But there are lots of opportunities that I have to kind of explain these things. And the reason I was really excited to get to talk to you about specifically adverse childhood experiences and these sorts of things because I'm still going to need to understand these languages. But it's also good to hear it from kind of different angles, different perspectives as people kind of come into this because you explain things different ways and different people are going to hear things in different ways. And so I was really excited to kind of talk a little bit about adverse childhood experiences and stuff with you today. So I guess for me, as somebody who occasionally is introducing people to this concept, how do you think is the best way to kind of introduce that concept or define adverse childhood experiences for somebody who's maybe kind of new to the space?
So I think that's kind of a $64,000 question. There are so many levels of relevance to talking about ACEs. To hit any one of those misses so much of the importance of all of the others, and to hit all of them overwhelms people. And so one of the things that we're trying to do in the Strong Brain Institute is to figure out our best messaging approach. So without knowing the best way to do it, what we tend to do is we talk about the early. So our focus isn't on how bad adversity is. We shouldn't have adversity. It's terrible. It's eliminated. Yeah. We know that's true. I believe that. The issue is, from my point of view, why does that matter? How does that affect our lives? And as a person who had, I had 7 ACEs the way that I counted. So I had a lot of adversity by definition. But I don't think of my childhood as traumatic. And so when I think back, I had a lot of bad things happen to me, like my mother suicided when I was 13. And that was terrible, and I wouldn't recommend anybody have that experience. But it wasn't traumatic. Looking at it from the outside, I'm sure people said it was, but I didn't classify it as that. It was just a thing that happened to me. It happened to a lot of other, people. A lot of other people in my life experienced death. Everybody dies. It's normal. It's unfortunate it happened this way. But what it does, the impact of that is that when children are experiencing an adversity, it activates their biological response system for stress. And stress is, it's good to have a biological response system that's built to respond to stress and to activate the fight, flight, freeze, or fawn mechanism to get the organism, the child, the whatever, out of the system that's causing the danger, the threat. That's excellent to have. The problem is when it's continuously and chronically activated, it wears on the system, it wears it down. And it tells the brain we have to adapt to an environment that's extremely threatening to our lives. And so the brain becomes wary, there's the developing child, or the child is exposed to abuse or neglect, is scared or frightened. The brain is telling that child, you know, giving it guidance about the best that the brain can do at that time. So the brains are magnificently flexible, adaptive, and plastic throughout the first 25 years of our life. And so if you're, a child is exposed to extreme and chronic stressors all the time, the brain's going to do a pretty good job of helping that child to survive, again, to the extent that it can. And that's great. The problem is, while the brain is making all these adaptations, it's kind of closing off some opportunities to go back to an optimally developing brain. And so the brain develops in response to expecting a life of stress. That's just not that helpful in other periods of life. So if you have a child who has a lot of adversity growing up, they have this chronic response, biological stress response, they have a brain that adapts to that, and then you release them into the workforce when they become 18, 19, 20, 21 years old. They have that brain that was adapted to seeing everything as threatening, but that's not helpful in the workplace because, well, maybe it is if the workplace is threatening, but hopefully in most workplaces it's not threatening. And you want to have an environment where that person can perform optimally. But if their brain is constantly expecting threat or criticism,
you're always out looking for that.
You're always looking for something, and you're not able to bring your whole self into the job. And so, it transcends that whole developmental period from birth all the way to, you know, employment.
Yeah, and the reason, you kind of said this, and the reason you said that we look at it so specifically in children is because that's when our brains are developing the most rapidly.
Yeah.
Right. So does that mean that is 25 kind of that cutoff point where that's where it really starts to, is your brain set where it's going to be at that point, or can we still kind of help people kind of rewire themselves even beyond that, even if their brain's kind of already gone through all those stressors early in life?
So those are really important neuroscience questions. We tend to use the term 25 years of age as sort of the, I don't want to say ending point because your brain constantly develops, but at around age 25 is when the frontal lobe, which is the regulatory part of the brain, it starts connecting to the emotional parts of the brain, finalizing its connections. And so when you're about 25 or 26 years old, you start making decisions that are a lot less impulsive.
So that's why I started making smarter decisions.
That's right, 100%. There's three major periods of brain development. One is the early childhood, when you have all the brain cells are basically present before birth. And then what happens right after birth, or the couple of years after birth, is the brain cells that aren't needed will die off. And the connections will start forming, and the connections that aren't needed will die off. That's called neural pruning. And you get a really efficient brain in that early part. Sometime around adolescence, during the period of puberty, there's another dose of hormones entering the system that causes the brain to develop further. And then in adulthood, you have that piece where the frontal lobe, early adulthood, late adolescence, the frontal lobe starting to connect to the limbic system and some of the more emotional systems.
It's fascinating how all that works. And so it's like, it's why we can learn so quickly. But
let me go back to the one more point, though. If your brain didn't continue developing for the rest of your life, you'd never be able to learn anything new.
Right.
Every time you learn something new, your brain is making
a new connection. That's why we say, I guess that's where that phrase, making the connections, comes from.
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah, because your brain's actually doing that. So I guess it's, and the reason I ask it that way is because, you know, like you're talking about, you're trying to create workplaces now where people are going to be aware that people have these potential, you know, struggles as they're trying to, you know, acclimate to new environments and that sort of thing. But we can still help people kind of see growth in their lives and make new connections and stuff as they're going. So just talking about kind of creating these kind of workplaces that people can work in. I know we hadn't mentioned the Strong Brain Institute a lot yet. How did that kind of get started, and what's kind of been your mission as part of the Strong Brain Institute?
The Strong Brain Institute?
Yeah.
The Strong Brain Institute was founded by a $1 million gift from Ballad Health over a 5-year period. Official start date, I think, was like June the 26th, 2020. But that resulted in, it was a gift from Ballad Health, which is our local healthcare system. But I think it happened as a result of a combination of Ballad's commitment to addressing adverse childhood experiences, in combination with President Nolan being aware of our there's a group of us on campus meeting to talk and talking about developing a center on trauma-informed practices. He knew about that, and so some magic happened somewhere. We ended up getting this gift. But the reason it came to our attention, your mother was one of the only people on campus, well, I can't say that definitely, one of the first people on campus who took the message of ACEs throughout the community
right.
and spread it. I remember she had a major event on campus, probably around 2014 or 2015, and then she had a major conference, I think around 2015. And at that time, I knew nothing about ACEs. I knew nothing about what your mom was doing. But because of my leadership role on campus, I became, and you were involved in some of these filming related to this.
Yeah.
I became connected with the Building Strong Brains Tennessee initiative. Building Strong Brains Tennessee was an initiative that started as a result of the Three Branches Institute in Tennessee, which is there was a judge and the governor and a legislator who were all familiar with ACEs and wanted to do something about ACEs to prevent them. So they met and found money to create this initiative that was called Building Strong Brains Tennessee. At that same time, I happened to be a presidential fellow with President Nolan of ETSU. I was griping about, I was at that point a department chair for 15 years, and I said things like, I need to expand, you know, do something more. And he had in his mind the idea of a leadership development group for you know, leaders like me that wanted a next step. And so as a result of that, I was a fellow, and he got an invitation to attend the kickoff for Building Strong Brains Tennessee, and he sent me to go. And that was awesome. And it turns out that my wife was already extremely well connected with a lot of the players.
Okay.
Essentially, Tennessee Commission on Children and Youth and Infant Court and a lot of things that were going on at the Nashville level, the state level. She was going to go anyway. President Nolan said, he sent me as his rep, and I went. And so it kind of was this, I'm like, sure, I'll go. I didn't want to go. Honestly, it sounded kind of boring to me, but I went. And then when I started seeing the speakers, I was blown away
right.
by all the things that this initiative was touching. One of the things that was there, one of the presenters that were there was Frameworks, the Frameworks Institute out of Boston, which uses evidence-based approaches for communicating and messaging. And I thought that I've long wished that there was an organization that did that, because there's a lot of messaging I wish we could message better.
Right.
And it turns out there was one, and I had never heard of them, and they were there, so I heard about their messaging around ACEs. Like I said, I didn't know anything about ACEs. We played the brain architecture game, and I'm one of those people, I hate these games, touchy-feely games, where you sit around in a group.
I try to come in late to meetings if I know.
Exactly. So I was probably actually texting your mom and saying, oh no, we're going to have to do, you know, manipulables.
I need you to call me with an emergency yeah. so I can leave real quick.
But yeah. Playing it with that brain architecture game was one of the foundational elements that got me motivated, because it was profound and it touched me deeply. And I love that game. And then I was like, they were saying things like, this initiative throughout the state needs to link to all the sectors. And I'm like, well, I'm a department chair. Like, I study babies, you know, professionally. I'm a developmental psychologist, but mostly I'm a department chair. Like, I don't see how this... Like, I don't do any child service, I'm not a human, part of a human service agency. You know, the people I work with were grown-ups, you know, for the most part, faculty you know.
I've interacted with some faculty. There's some child development that's still going on there.
It's true. Young adults.
No offense, of course.
Absolutely. And so over time, and I kept going, they had a series of events over time. Frameworks Institutes, and one of the things that I would ask the leader at that time, Mary Rolando, was like, why do you see higher ed is involved? And she said she wasn't sure how higher ed was involved, but it had to be. And so I started, at that point, I started thinking about, well, I'm in higher ed. I'm a child psychologist. Like, I ought to be able to figure out something to do here. And so what I did was I created a group of, I asked around on campus. It turns out, you know, your mom was one of them. There's a lot of people that were doing work in ACEs, a lot more than I realized. And people were doing science on it. People were also getting grants from the state on it. And I brought all those people together, like, let's talk. is there anything that we have common or in interest, anything that we could do with this common passion of addressing adversity? And this group began meeting monthly, probably for, 2-3 years. And two things were striking about it. We all were committed to meeting, even though nobody likes meetings. We kept coming. People kept coming, and the group kept growing. And we all wanted to develop a presence, more of it, on campus. And so we invited President Nolan, at that time Provost Wilsey Bishop, to meet with us and talking about it, what could we do? Like, we have all this interest and passion. What could we do about this? And then President Nolan suggested that we submit an application for creating a center. And your mom was always wanting a center on campus. And
we had many conversations at many dinner tables.
I'm sure you did. Yeah. And so for him to suggest this, even without us putting that in his mind, was like perfect. Nailed
it.
This is it. And then we didn't hear from President Nolan for about a year. And he's, very busy person. And but when we heard from him, he says, "I got the money for your center." And it was the money that Ballad wanted to give to us. Ballad was giving us other money for the, I'm not exactly sure, but like the Rural Health Research Institute.
Right, yeah.
And that was like a $10 million gift. So for this $1 million gift for our ACES Institute, Strong Brain Institute, was probably, from their point of view, might have been relatively minimal. I don't know. I know as far as the COPA goes,
right,
they have to distribute so many millions of dollars in the community, and we're happy to be a recipient of
it.
And so that started in the middle of COVID in 2020.
I remember the picture when they announced it, because we're all spread out over the stairs and spaced out nice and evenly.
I have a great picture of that, and I like to juxtapose that with a similar picture of the Avengers. There's one Avengers movie where all the the different superheroes are standing in a circle fighting off the bad people coming from the Cosmere or whatever. And I remember that reminded me, seeing all of us out there.
We're all here, and
we're
finally going to do the thing.
We're fighting
your masks, ready to go. Yeah,
that was a great day.
Yeah, because at the time I was still doing video at ETSU, and so I remember I videoed the stuff for the rural health stuff, and I came over and I videoed lots of press conferences and these sorts of things. But this was one that was like, for once I actually kind of knew what was going on as I was filming these things, and it makes it a lot easier to tell that story when you actually are kind of connected to what all's going on in there. So it sounds like there were a lot of people kind of discovering ACES kind of all at the same time from different places, then kind of getting to see all that kind of come together. If you're comfortable answering, was there anything personal that was kind of motivating you to really pursue it? Or was it just like, this just seems like a natural expression of the stuff that I've been studying for my whole career?
There's a couple more layers that I didn't mention so far. At the same time that I was the presidential fellow and that I was going to Building Strong Brains Tennessee Kickoff, I was also co-chair of the ETSU Strategic Planning Committee. And one of the things that we talked about on that committee was, what can we do to make ETSU stand out? Like, to be special. Like, if you go to App State, all of us have different attractive features. All of the universities have different attractive features. App State has the mountains, and they have that strong football team. And I think ETSU is doing a better job building its identity and calling the area the Appalachian Highlands. I think it's really good for helping our brand. I'm sorry, remind me of the question.
What was kind of motivating you to kind of go down?
Yeah. So because of that, I was, so two things. One was that we could bring in an ACES initiative. I had this unformed idea that maybe ETSU could be a trauma-informed university. And wouldn't that be cool? That would allow us to stand out. And now I don't think that's a great idea. We have more data on that kind of label. There might be alternative approaches. But the other thing that I would also describe as personal was, for years I had been frustrated as a department chair with the inability to achieve objectives. For whatever reason, there's some bureaucratic limit here, or some rule against this thing or that thing, or people were absent, like key people that to get anything done, you had to have their signature, and they'd be on, you know, some break for 2 or 3 weeks at a time, and there's no backup bench person to sign, and so everybody's waiting for this person to come back from whatever they were off. And not to say that people shouldn't have time off of work. The problem was there was no backup, no other person.
No other support.
And so those kinds of things are frustrating when you're an administrator. And like sort of the idea was, if you have a trauma-informed approach, maybe we can start addressing some of these issues to make life easier in a bureaucracy as complicated as ETSUs.
Yeah, that's a fascinating look at things. Because, I mean, I know one of the things that we talk about when we're trying to help train people in trauma-informed care is, you know, consistency, you know, being there, being trustworthy, mm-hmm. and consistency and reliable. Following through on the things that you're talking to people about. And, you know, even just from the, can I get that thing signed when I know I need to get that signed? Because this is important to me. And it's going to appear to me that you don't care about me, even if you're just on vacation and there's not a support system to make sure that I'm going to be able to get to the things, the services or the access points or the signatures. That's a really unique way of looking at how we structure our organizations.
Well, outside of a trauma-informed, I mean, it doesn't, having a, being aware of trauma-informed practices doesn't solve the problem, but it does give you new perspective.
Right.
So, let's just take, for example, let's say we need somebody to sign something. And like, we want to hire somebody, say. We want to hire a new faculty member, and we can't hire them without this signature. But the person who needs to give that signature is out of the office. Maybe it's for maternity leave, or maybe it's for vacation or whatever. You know, the old way is like, just getting angry about the whole thing, and like your obstacles are being blocked by this person who's not in their job, and you could use whatever name calling that you want. It's not helpful, but that's what we tend to do. When you have a trauma-informed approach, you start looking at this whole thing systemically. Like, what are the systems in place? And what are the limitations? Like, instead of assuming that the other people are incompetent because they can't sign your contract, you start thinking, well, what kind of systems might be at play that prevents that person or that office from being able to sign the contract? And you start thinking, oh, well, maybe they have limitations too. Like, maybe they don't have enough resources for them to hire enough staff.
They may be feeling the exact same things.
They might be frustrated that they can't sign your contract just as much as you are. And when you look at it that way, then you look at people as team members rather than competitors or adversaries. And so that whole approach gives you sort of a new way, a new fresh air, a new breath of fresh air to dig into solving some of those problems.
Yeah, one of the metaphors I use a lot when I talk about this kind of stuff is just having a new lens to kind of see things.
The lens is a great metaphor.
It's a completely different way of seeing people, but now also even just systems themselves, like seeing systems for different reasons, because they have their own purposes, and love that, having their own limitations piece too. And I think it's important for people who maybe don't understand any of the, I'm just thinking like general population too, the people that obviously Strong Brain Institute's trying to help get this messaging out to, people we're trying to get this messaging out to. Why do you think understanding ACEs, trauma-informed principles, these sorts of things is so important for the general population?
So, I mean, there's two levels of things. If we could make sure everybody understood everything, then we would all be nicer to each other. We'd have happier workplaces.
Yeah.
We'd be tolerant. We'd get along. We'd belong. We'd bring our whole selves to work. I mean, in my opinion, that's what would happen if we got everybody to understand the message we're trying to convey. The problem is the message is so complicated that you can't deliver it all at once, and when you deliver it over time, people lose interest, or they get caught up on certain aspects of the message. Like, for example, when we got the first contract from the Tennessee Department of Health Office of Injury Prevention to develop our Better Workplaces Tennessee program, we first called it the Trauma-Informed Workplaces Program because it used trauma-informed, you know, practices. Well, that turns off, the term trauma turns off so many people. They don't want to hear about it. They're tired of hearing about trauma. Like, people are trying to get off without doing, you know, picking themselves up by the bootstraps. Yeah. So the word trauma doesn't really capture what we're trying to convey. What we're trying to convey is a whole system of using trauma-informed approaches, which are based on the best practices for working with people who do have, you know, extenuating extreme adverse experiences growing
right,
up,
yeah.
who've been abused, severely abused, neglected. Like, we want to create environments where those people can be safe. At the same time, it turns out that these very same practices, what we call trauma-informed practices, they have a complete evidence base in this whole other literature that I would describe as industrial organizational psychology or organizational behavior, organizational management. All of these principles are the same principles that work in both settings, but they go by two different nomenclatures, and I'm not convinced that these people, like the groups of people who are working in these two areas, even know much about each other, or that they're talking about the same
thing. They don't know
things.
That they're on the same team on
this. I don't think that they do. Now that's an empirical question.
Like, right.
Maybe they do. But when I've gone and talked to my colleagues at child psychology conferences, they've never heard of ACEs before. And when I go to people I have some colleagues, not many, but I have some who are in team building, industrial organizational scientists. When I talk to them about adversity, they really haven't heard about it either. So I don't think that these two sort of systems of scientific, not just science, but practical implementation, I don't think they know much about each other.
Yeah.
So one of my goals is to try to have these groups talk to each other and develop better
messaging. See if we can unify that language a
little
bit.
The language,
yeah.
Coherent language, get away from anything that people describe as off-putting. Like, if I said two things, would you rather be in a trauma-informed team or a well-functioning team? In my view, those are the same exact thing.
Right.
But most people would interpret those as meaning completely different things.
Yeah. Yeah. And one kind of focuses more on what you're trying to fix, and one focuses
yeah.
more on what you're trying to be.
That's
or
right.
something like
That's
that.
Right.
Even though both are trying to say the same thing,
yeah.
if you don't understand all that language. But obviously, it's still important to kind of understand kind of the underlying concepts mm-hmm. of the adversity
right.
and the trauma and those sorts of things. Have you noticed when you get to talk to people that maybe haven't heard that language before, is there some sort of perceived shift in the way that they kind of view their workplace or view themselves or view the people they work with after they've kind of been kind of exposed to these concepts or anything like that for the first time?
It goes a couple of different ways. Sometimes people go in the wrong direction. They're like, they don't want to hear about it. You know, drive tested the construct of a trauma-informed university at one point. And we had a meeting with about 20 or 30 department chairs. And we did a very brief trauma training, and we did focus groups. What do you think about these ideas? Because we literally think that trauma-informed practices is one way to promote enrollment growth at any university. And in our case, you know, we're focused on ETSU. And some of the chairs, they missed the point entirely. Like, one chair said, well, that's only for psychology. Well, I was the psychology department chair at that time, and I'm like, no, it's not. It's like, all your students in your class would benefit from trauma-informed practices. But even though we said that, it missed the point. Another person described it as, I would never want my daughter to go to a school that had to describe itself as trauma-informed. So we hadn't even thought about that. Like, oh yeah, I guess that could be perceived negatively. Like, you had so much trauma, you had to trauma inform your school, and that's bad. I don't want to have my kid go to a school.
Especially if people don't understand what you mean by
trauma.
Right,
exactly.
They don't understand the language the way that we're using it.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
That's interesting. So then, as you had those conversations, have you found language that you think has been more effective? Have there been studies on some of those? I know you're talking about, you like data. Has there been any data that's come out that says, here's some better ways that we can be, some better ways that we can describe some of these concepts that's going to help people
no.
be more receptive?
I mean, yet? To my knowledge, no. And one of our goals is to do research on messaging. And we've done some studies. We haven't published them yet.
Yeah.
Been pretty busy, and we just can't get
yeah.
to publishing
it's
those.
It's good to be busy. It's also good to get the publishing
right.
stuff done.
Yeah. Yeah, so we've done some studies where we've asked people, how do you feel about this word? And the word might be trauma-informed. And we might say, well, how do you feel about this word? And it might be transparency, which is one of the trauma-informed best practices.
Right.
Going back to your last question, the first response that we got was some people misunderstood and viewed it negatively, but some people got it. And
yeah.
we describe it as like drinking the Kool-Aid. It's probably not the best metaphor, but it's like, once people sort of see it and they find that lens and they put
yeah.
that lens on, they suddenly see things they never saw before. So you get those two kinds of reactions, like this is awesome, it's the best thing since baked bread, and or like, I don't want to be anywhere near that initiative. So that's
yeah.
that's kind of like what we're trying to the bridge we're trying to build between
yeah.
those two groups.
And I know, so because I've had different conversations about this stuff with different people, and I get kind of the same response. Like, some people's like, I see it. This is perfect. Everybody needs to hear this. And then some people, and usually they don't come and tell me directly. Usually it's, I hear it through the grapevine. They're like, I don't need any of that brain stuff. Yeah. That's not helpful. And it's like, well, that probably means I didn't communicate it as effectively as I could. Because I feel like it's not that I'm just trying to say it's only the, like you said, it's not only useful for psychology. It's not only useful for just brain development, but it's just understanding what's happening is helpful to inform the way that I can treat somebody when I'm interacting with them.
Yeah, I mean,
anyway, and no matter what, they've had adversity or not, a lot of it's just, this is just good ways to be a nice, empathetic person,
you know,
and that's really, that's helpful for just any place that you're working or any people that you're working with. So if people were wanting to get more involved in serving people, because that's what a lot of what we're trying to do is help motivate people to want to serve people. Or they're just interested in maybe getting to understand the people around them better. What do you think the best place to start is? And what's the place that you would, what's a good entry point into this?
I haven't even thought about that.
Oh, I found a good question. One that you haven't thought about. I tried to stump you.
Yeah. Because
one of the things that you said at the beginning was, you know, you understand one piece, but there's so much that you're already missing.
Yeah.
Do you think there's one of those pieces that tends to kind of help open up the rest of that in more effective ways for people?
If somebody said, I want to learn more, I could give them material for them to learn more. I think a really good introduction is the Nadine Burke Harris TED Talk. It's only 20 minutes long. You know, she was the first Surgeon General of the state of California, and she got her notoriety in a positive sense in the state of California because of her ACEs research. She identified this whole neglected area, I believe, in the Oakland area. And it wasn't served because it was an impoverished area and no pediatrician set up practices. So she created a special pediatric practice there. And she would see a lot of kids whom we would describe as with high ACE scores, high adversity, high trauma experiences. And physically, nothing was wrong with these children, but they weren't thriving. They weren't growing. And she was one of the people that said, this adversity thing that they're experiencing, that's actually preventing them from growing, even though all of their physical needs are being met by public resources.
Right.
And so as a result of that, she did some deep diving, and she has a great book, the title which I can't generate at this time, but published that book, did that TED Talk, and opened a lot of eyes. And then because of that, I think created ACEs Awareness, which is a California campaign, or ACEs Aware, I think it's called. And was identified as the first Surgeon General as a pediatrician. That's pretty impressive.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. So and again, it doesn't matter how you find your way in, as long as you kind of, from my perspective, it's like just find it. But that's a great place to start. I guess, have there been any challenges or struggles in working in this area along the way for you?
Yes. You know, we're in year five of the Ballad Gift, and so that money goes away. We've since been able to generate about $3 million of extramural funding with another $3 million that we've submitted grants applications for to hopefully keep this work going. So, you know, when you got one eye on the science and then one eye on finding money to keep the science going, it's distracting.
Right.
So that's a challenge. We're grateful that we have the money to do the work that we have done and can continue to do. But we do have to expend a lot of energy in that direction. And the messaging challenge, you know, is always there. Like, how do we best put this message out there? How do we reach the most amount of people?
We kind of already talked a little bit about this, but I just figured I'd get your opinion on this. So for people that have kind of had significant adverse experiences in their past, what have you seen be the most effective ways of providing support for people? Because, I mean, we're kind of looking at the what's happened, but I know you all are also seeing people putting these things into practice. Have you had any success stories of places that you've worked with or organizations or even individual interactions that maybe you've had? You know, have you seen anything be particularly effective along the way as you're trying to, you know, install these practices into different workplaces or into even your own office at ETSU or anything like that?
So this divides into what we might describe as clinical, non-clinical areas, or individual versus systemic areas. And my focus is on systems, workplace systems and academic systems. I'm a developmental psychologist, but I'm not a clinical psychologist. Right. I think there are incredible movements in those areas. There's an organization in Tennessee called the Association of Infant Mental Health in Tennessee, AIM High Tennessee. They have their work doing a lot of work in this area, promoting and helping and supporting Tennessee's babies and mothers and families. So that's an excellent resource. What we're trying to do in Better Workplaces Tennessee is we're trying to give workplaces a toolkit that they can use internally to help to be what we describe as move forward on their journey for becoming trauma-informed. We have three recognized workplaces that have achieved the silver level, and the first one was Appalachian Promise Alliance, and it used to be Bristol's Promise, but now they're called Appalachian Promise Alliance, or the APA. And one of the individuals from the APA that we were working with, who was one of, on our team, Better Workplaces Tennessee team, worked at APA and she wasn't involved in the process of becoming trauma-informed, but described that in the process of them identifying they have to become a better workplace, they're supposed to develop a strategic synergy plan, and that strategic synergy plan is meant to emerge out of distribution of power, giving power to everybody in the organization who can sit around a table in the strategic synergy team to develop, to begin talking about how they can implement trauma-informed practices in their business practices. And she described what it was like at those meetings, that she could just feel that people were more comfortable around each other as they were talking about and exposing assumptions that they previously never had a reason to talk about. So she said that
giving people that voice, that ability to
have a place to talk about things they're thinking about. Otherwise, you don't have a place to talk about.
And feel like you're seen, heard, all of those things.
Right.
And you've said the word belong a couple of different times. Yeah. And I think that's really fascinating. That's cool.
Well, yeah. So, you know, looking at the pillars of SAMHSA, one of the SAMHSA pillars is collaboration.
Right.
And another one is mutuality. And the idea of that we're part of a team, we're all in this together, you know, we're trying, you know, I believe that there are good reasons that you have a hierarchical administrative structure, but sometimes having a hierarchy or a power differential can prevent really good ideas from coming forward, either because people don't feel comfortable or they don't feel psychologically safe enough to introduce those in team meetings. But if you have a trauma-informed group or if a trauma-informed angle, or if you identify as looking at your workplace through a trauma-informed lens, then it's expected for people to come forward with suggestions for improvement.
Everybody feels valuable. Yeah.
Everybody feels valuable, and no one should feel being attacked because somebody else criticizes. I mean, it depends on how you do it. You can't just go after people. But if somebody has an idea, puts it forward, turns out it's a bad idea, somebody ought to be able to say that's not a good idea. And the person who generated it shouldn't take offense at that.
Just like they shouldn't be afraid to offer the idea, they shouldn't be afraid to hear that somebody might disagree with their idea because they're all trying to hopefully work toward that same end goal of finding the best solution, whatever the problem is.
Yeah. And in the United States, we are such a agency, independence oriented country. We're not very collectivistic. A trauma-informed approach kind of tries to level the playing field, making things a little more, you know, fair and distributing the power so everybody feels comfortable bringing their ideas forward. So it's like you're as important as I am in this, and I'm going to give some of my power to you now so that you can bring forward your ideas, and I'm not going to, you know, even though I might be your boss, nothing you say here is I'm going to take against you because I want to create an environment where you feel comfortable sharing your ideas.
Yeah, because I keep coming back to the same idea. If you're working at the same organization, that organization has a mission. And theoretically, you're both not working on your own individual paths that are opposed to that mission. But theoretically, if you're working on the same mission, then it should mean that you should trust each other to be pushing in that same
And so
direction.
Establishing that trust, it's all relationship-based. This is the other thing. I mean, I think as trauma-informed workplace starts with quality relationships, working on relationships, everything is relationship-based.
Which is kind of the fixed, not fixed, that's not the right language to use, but I'm just trying to think, like, so much of the things that we talked about at the beginning, the adverse childhood experiences, are kind of the breaking of connection, breaking of community.
That's
and it's kind of the solution is bringing people back together.
That's excellent. I mean, that's a good way to frame that. Exactly. Yeah.
So if you're comfortable answering this, I would love to kind of hear your perspective, because you kind of have a unique perspective from a lot of the people that I end up talking to running in circles in this, because we are trying to develop some of this mentality, this mindset, this lens to look through within the faith community. I know that you kind of have an external view of the faith community in there. So I'm just curious if you would be willing to give me kind of your opinion on what are some ways that we can communicate these practices better to the faith community, or what are some things that the faith community needs to understand better if we're going to serve better?
I'm not afraid to answer that. I'm just not sure how to answer that.
I mean,
I think in any group is based, as you already identified, has a common set of objectives.
Right.
And anything that allows you to better achieve those objectives should be, and doesn't harm others in the process, should be embraced by members of that group. And I just would imagine that in the faith community isn't this monolith. The faith community is, you know, individual groups. There's individual churches. There's individual faith traditions. You know, there's bigger exo or macro differences. But at all levels, it seems to me, from what I understand of the faith of most faith communities, is that groups are trying to achieve some purpose or objective.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine how a trauma-informed approach would interfere with the ability to achieve those.
Right. So we've kind of talked about, you know, different people kind of perceiving, you know, trauma-informed practices from different perspectives within the church. I've run into some, you know, roadblocks along the way of, you know, we don't trust the psychology stuff. We don't trust the science stuff. It's easy. It's not surprising to hear that the faith community would kind of feel that way. And I would imagine that sometimes there's the academia side of it where it's like, we don't necessarily feel that they might have kind of a similar response to the faith side of it. Do you think there are some ways that we could kind of find some of that collaboration, mutuality, and find some common objectives?
Yeah.
There?
So I think what you do is you get together and you talk and you start forming those relationships. But it's going to take certain kinds of people. It's going to take let's suppose that we're only talking about people in the faith community and scientists, just those very big distinctions.
This is painting with a broad brush, but yeah.
Very broad brush. But the scientists, like your mother and I, are a really good microcosm of this example. Like, we've worked together for 23 years now. Looking at how we did it, we're the places that we can have differences. We don't let those enter our conversations. For the most part, it's really not relevant. And so we focus on where we have our common objectives.
What are we
objectives.
Working on that's the same
What are we working
mission?
On that we agree that we're working
right.
on? And so our relationship is largely focused on that. And so we can talk to each other for hours and hours and even develop a friendship and go out for lunch or dinner or whatever. And only because our work is focused in going in the same direction. So that work relationship, we don't let the other things get in the way of where we are, at least we haven't, allows us to carry that relationship outside of
right.
the traditional workplace, and so that we can be friends outside of the workplace.
Yeah. More connection, more communication, more community. I mean, those are the kinds of things that we talk about all the time, and it sounds like those are kind of reflected in a lot of these principles as well.
Well, I was going to add that it takes her a lot, I imagine. I don't know. We haven't talked about this. To put aside, you know, any of her faith stuff. And I don't mean disrespect.
No.
But whatever she's bringing with her, it's not at the forefront of our conversation. And she's also a scientist, you know, so she's got whatever.
She calls herself a Venn diagram all the time.
She does.
She's
call
a little
herself
bit of,
a Venn
like
diagram.
A little bit of everything.
Yeah. And I also call myself a scientist. But, you know, in terms of administration, that's one thing she hasn't been and she doesn't want to be is an administrator of a department or a dean or something like that.
I could
that.
Not imagine.
So
I would feel so bad for those people.
So we can talk about these things like when we have a very defined in that Venn diagram, there's some areas of overlap in the Venn diagram where we can talk. And we've kind of inadvertently outlined those. I mean,
yeah.
We could probably do it more explicitly. And there's some places we just don't because it's going to end up in an argument or disagreement or something.
Yeah. But again, even if you end up in those places, I feel like it sounds like because you both have going back to those trauma-informed principles, because you kind of have that trust relationship already established, it makes it easier to get back to that point, that healthy point of these are the things that we're working on that are together, and that helps you kind of keep pushing toward that ultimate objective.
Yeah, and any opportunity to disagree or debate or whatever, that just distracts us from our common core.
And I think that's helpful for people that listen to this, because like I said, we have kind of a mix of objectives within this podcast, in that we're hoping to get, you know, hear the science side, hear some of the faith side, hear the story side, all of these things. But I think just hearing that we need to find those places where we are working toward the same goals and kind of get to, because again, we're looking at it from the addiction side, you know, and trying to help people find success in lives of flourishing beyond, you know, the addiction or whatever it is that they find themselves, the situation they find themselves in. But it sounds like if we can all just kind of find where are the common threads that are pulling us together, we might can even be more effective at finding that most effective language that's going to help people the most along the way as we kind of...
Yeah, so getting a little erudite or nerdy, the idea of a collective impact model, if you're not familiar with that, is something that a lot
Educate me.
So a collective, it's kind of a simple model that if you have a lot of organizations or groups working toward the same objective, the collective impact model says, let's talk about this together so that we're all moving in the same direction, because otherwise we're competing for resources and we're working against each other. And, you know, like Ballot Health has the strong ACC and it's composed of something like over 350 different organizations, workplaces, agencies. And basically, they're all trying to improve the human condition throughout our region. 350 different organizations are trying to improve, you know, humanity throughout the region, and they're trying to go after all of the same resources. Well, if they know that they're all doing that, then maybe they can be more effective if they identify commonalities of objectives and working together. So just imagine the case where maybe an easy image is if you have a lot of arrows on an image, and the arrows are pointing in all different directions. And each one of those arrows represents an agency and its mission. And that's the way it is in many, it probably is here somewhat now in our region. A collective impact model takes all those arrows and orients them in the same direction. They can still be different size arrows and thicknesses and lengths and colors, but they're, instead of pointing in all different directions, they're all pointing in the same direction. And the idea is, but that requires coordination and collaboration. And to do that requires what's called a backbone. And a backbone organization is an organization which is willing to allow some of its resources to be directed toward establishing this collective impact model. So in the case of some of the trauma-informed initiative building, I don't remember the backbone was for Building Strong Brains Tennessee. It might have been the executive branch. It might have been the governor's office.
Right.
But more locally, we have a couple of initiatives locally which are backboned by. I'm trying to think of
I mean, that's not too different from some of how like Uplift Appalachia right now. We're partnering with a couple of different grant
recipients.
Have you
heard the term backbone before?
I can kind of interpret what you're saying,
yeah.
But I don't know if I've heard it used in this exact context, but I mean, we're partnering right now with the First Tennessee Development District on a grant for helping folks who are in recovery develop job skills so they can get jobs. They're
right.
First Tennessee Development
yeah.
District trying to help people get jobs.
Yeah.
And so there are now multiple organizations who maybe individually would be fighting for the same funds,
right.
Kind of like you were saying,
yeah.
But now we're all kind of able to kind of receive kind of sub awards within those grants. So we get to help provide some transportation. Another organization is providing the housing. Another organization is providing the the job training. And all of that's being kind of managed by the First Tennessee Development District, who's...
So it sounds like they're playing a backbone role.
They're basically
role
our
case.
Backbone yeah. role in that. We have meetings and they kind of make sure that things are happening, but they're not necessarily the boots on the ground. There
right.
are all these other
That's
organizations
right.
that are the
but
boots on the ground.
But they're tracking what all's happening.
They're tracking what all's happening.
And they're the go-to if
they're
any of those
the ones that we have to
questions.
Make sure we're fulfilling all of our obligations, because
right.
they're the ones that are reporting back to the
yeah,
state
right.
saying, hey, these are the things that... It's kind of a similar relationship that Uplift ended up having with the Strong Brain Institute, too,
yeah.
where we're helping develop some... messaging for, you know,
right.
workplaces and organizations yeah. in the recovery community, that sort of thing as well. But again, it's all, if we can kind of unify that, it's unifying the message and unifying the mission part that is sometimes the hardest but if you can do it, because like you were saying earlier, it's like if half your time you're distracted just trying to get the next round of funding, you're not being nearly
yeah.
as effective at the thing you're hoping
That's
to
right.
actually accomplish. But if we can all kind of get going on the same track, and we can be less distracted by the fundraising part than we actually get to do the fun part, which is hopefully learning things and then helping people with the things that we learn.
Yeah.
Well, this has been really helpful for me, because like I said, I'm just happy to hear different ways of approaching a lot of these same concepts. Because you hear it one way the whole time. You know, I do a training and I say it the same way 10 times in a row, but it's nice to kind of hear it from different perspective, coming from a different background, and kind of the way that you found yourself in. So this has been really helpful for me.
When you talk about the training, that's one thing that we're really interested in studying too, is around the nation, around probably globally, people are doing these adversity trainings or ACEs trainings, or the new approach with positive childhood experiences or PCEs. Everybody's doing these trainings, but no one's actually tracking a fidelity of the trainings to the original training. So a lot of people learn how to do their trainings from a training that's called Training for Trainers.
Right.
And the Training for Trainers trainer trains everybody, and then they go out and do their trainings, but there's no effort, and probably because of lack of resources, to make sure that those trainings are fidelitous to the original training. So there's a real opportunity to do science on that part of it, but also to look at the long-term effect. When you do the training, nobody ever goes back. Again, no one has the resources to see what happened as a result of the training. Did things get better? In Better Workplaces Tennessee, one of the things we're doing, we do a training, but then we track the workplace over the course of years,
right?
And compare the data.
What's the long-term effect of this?
What's the long-term effect? And are the outcomes better? If the outcomes aren't better, then obviously the training didn't work. But you got to have the resources to track those outcomes and publish those outcomes.
Which is why it's so important that if you come to one of our trainings and we put that QR code up at the end,
right,
please fill out that survey at the end. It's actually helpful for science.
That's right.
We're gonna help people get even better, because we're gonna get better at getting this information.
That's right.
Yeah. It seems like such a one off thing to take the survey at the end of a class, but it's like maybe there's actually some real value in taking those kinds of
things. Well, yeah, and also they don't want to hurt your feelings.
Yeah.
especially if they like you.
Yeah.
So many times when I go to my conferences or whatever, it's like these people put on a really good conference. Maybe it was too cold, chairs were too hard. But gosh, I am not going to complain about that, because I loved everything else, and I don't really need them to walk away thinking that my focus was on the hardness of the chairs.
Right.
But, at the other hand, if you don't tell them that, they won't know that.
Yeah.
But
that might have been a limiting factor to someone else. It might not have been to you, because you were in, but it's like, if that helps somebody else down the road,
they need to know
an improvement.
That's right.
It's okay. You're not going to hurt feelings. They're asking because they actually want to know.
Yeah.
Which is...
Yeah, but you got to convince the responders that even if it does hurt your feelings, it's okay, because you need to
I need to have my feelings hurt so that I can build myself back up.
Nobody needs to have their feelings hurt. But, if you explain to them that, so what if your feelings get hurt? That you still need to know that, because you don't want to keep hurting other people, and you need to have the data to make your decisions moving forward.
Yeah. So that's the goal, so that we can make better decisions as we're going forward. Well, is there anything else that you're working on right now that you're really excited about seeing come to fruition, or anything that you have coming down the line that you think is important for people to be looking out for?
Well, not something that people can look out for broadly, but we do have another contract with the Tennessee Department of Health. We're working with leadership within the Tennessee Department of Health to help create sort of what I would describe as a trauma-informed workplace for health workers. One of the things that I don't think many of us realized was how stressful COVID was for health workers everywhere. And the fact that they didn't have massive turnover tells you how committed these folks are to their jobs. But it was still stressful, and they felt a lot of that stress. And nobody likes to see people that they are working with die. So there was a sense within the Tennessee Department of Health that we need to pay close attention to keeping our workforce healthy, safe, and feeling good about their jobs, and because they were getting information from the workforce that things weren't okay. And so they rose to the occasion. They are contracting with us, and we're developing with them in full collaboration with them, really with them taking the lead, but using the resources that we can bring to bear in implementing a trauma-informed workforce approach to the whole entire Tennessee Department of
Health. That's huge.
That's huge. It is pretty huge.
Really exciting.
Yeah.
So what's the timeline for rolling that kind of thing out?
So that's a four-year contract.
Okay.
We're about in the first year was planning and development, initial data collection. So we've surveyed the workforce
sometimes.
We've spent a lot of time working with leadership in the Tennessee Department of Health, identifying strategies, thinking about how we want to do this. We're getting ready for a kickoff event in May with senior leadership in Tennessee Department of Health. It's really important to involve as many people as possible all the way through. So we're going to have a pre-meeting next week with senior leaders, and then an in-person meeting in May with senior leaders to talk about how we do this, to use their thoughts and bring those thoughts into with us so that our thoughts are informed by their thoughts, and it's a true collaborative mutual relationship.
That's exciting.
So as that rolls out, I can't say that anything, the public would necessarily
see. You're not going to necessarily see it, but it's going to be felt throughout.
It will be felt throughout
the ripple effect,
the health system where people hope, the idea is that people are going to be happier and more satisfied in the workplace, less likely to, change jobs and increase retention.
Which will help with the
costs,
care that they're able to provide as well.
Right.
I mean, all that's going to, you won't know that that's what it is, but it will hopefully be impacting everybody in some way.
And if you keep workers, then it's cheaper too. You're not having to constantly retrain new people coming on board all the time.
There's an actual economic impact.
Impact.
That's really cool. Well, that's fascinating. So, thank you so much for sitting down chatting with me. This was a really helpful conversation for me, and I'm going to hopefully be able to go back, take all this stuff down and incorporate it into some of the language that we're using as we're doing a lot of our work as well. So thank you.
I'm
so
glad
much.
To be here, and thanks for thinking.
Yeah, and also thank you for being nice to my mom, as hard as that is sometimes.
Yeah, so we make a good team.
Yeah, it's been good. Thanks.
This has been a podcast powered by Uplift Appalachia. To learn more, you can find us at upliftappalachia.org.